You're listening to The Plug with Neil Griffiths.
All right, hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Plug Podcast. If you haven't done it already, subscribe, rate, and review the podcast wherever you are listening to this episode from. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, at The Plug with Neil Griffiths, or on TikTok, at theplug.podcast. Thanks again for listening, and it's another big episode. This week, my guest is US band all-time low, and more specifically, frontman Alex Gasgarth and lead guitarist Jack Barakat. Alex and Jack jumped on the podcast fresh off a European tour and the band's latest album. It's called Tell Me I'm Alive, and it is out right now. We sat down to talk about the new record, their upcoming US tour, head to alltimelow.com for tickets, and the reaction from fans to the new music. We also talked about their upcoming set at When We Were Young Festival, Alex shares his theory on why pop punk is back in a big way, and we all fanboyed over Blink-182 just a little bit. Here it is, All Time Low's Alex and Jack join me now on The Plug Podcast. All right, welcoming to the podcast, Alex Gasgarth, Jack Barakat from All Time Low. Guys, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having us.
Woo! We jumped on this call all of 35 seconds ago. You guys have just gotten back from the UK. You just did a live stream show, which I was lucky to check out, from the famous Wembley OVO Wembley Arena. Is that the correct?
OVO Lacto Intolerant Wembley Arena.
Perfect. Well, congratulations, guys. It was a great show. It was good to see you back on stage.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a wild night. I mean, the added pressure of the live stream aside, like, that venue is so incredible and iconic, and just I can't think of a better place to put on a CD release show. Mm. It was very special.
Well, while being an arena, it doesn't feel like it.
No.
Like, it really? Just feels like you're playing, like, it kind of feels like you're playing a massive rock club just because of, like, the layout, and it just, yeah, I don't know. It's really special.
Arenas can feel very spread out, and it kind of sometimes comes across like the crowd is really far away from you. Mm. But for whatever reason, Wembley, with its massive floor, and they just fit so many people down on that floor, it kind of feels more like a festival.
Yeah.
It really, like, the energy doesn't get offset by the fact that people are, like, further away.
Yeah, yeah. And was that the last show of that European leg?
It was. We kind of went all over mainland Europe. Then we jumped over to Dublin and Glasgow and wound up there. And it was sort of the perfect culmination because for the most part, the rest of the tour was a club tour. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of building up and building up and building up to this moment. And we got to kind of size up the production and everything. It was a special night.
Yeah. Well, guys, congratulations on the album. Tell Me I'm Alive. Usually when we have bands on the podcast, it's album release week, or maybe it's a few weeks before. The album has been out for a few days, all of, what, 72 hours. How's the reception been on your end?
Seems amazing.
It seems good. You know what? It's like, I barely have been able to get a gauge of what people think yet, because, like, we did the show Friday, was crazy. Then we did two acoustic performances on Saturday, and then we took a 10-hour flight back from London yesterday and landed at, like, 10 p.m. And then here we are. So, like, I haven't even had a chance to, like, sit down and gauge what people think, but I hope they like it.
Yeah, you kind of, we're in, like, promo mode right now. And so it's all just feeling so fresh and new. But yeah, like, I mean, I've had a few moments to just kind of stop, take pause, and, like, look at what people are saying. And it feels overwhelmingly positive, which is really, it's kind of a nice moment to let yourself finally take in. Because you spend so much of the time making this music and trying to perfect it as much as you can without messing it up. And then you kind of sit on it for a while, and there's all this sort of, at least for me personally, like, it definitely becomes this, like, swirling moment of self-doubt, where it's like, is this music good enough? Are people going to like it? Does anything I do matter? And I talked to all of those things about my therapist, but despite that, you know, it's you can't help but feel it. And so, like, it's nice when the music finally drops and you do get that payoff and you see a little bit of feedback. It's great. We're in that phase now.
And unlike Wake Up Sunshine, where we didn't get to play Wake Up Sunshine until over a year after it came out.
Which is wild.
And so, like, we never got that feeling of, like, these songs are connecting with anyone. Mm-hmm. Like, you had no idea. And it turns out they were connecting, but we had no idea and you didn't feel it. So the fact that we were playing four new songs off the record, like, you know, Calm Down, Tell Me I'm Alive, Modern Love, and Sleepwalking, we may all play those live for the last month and feel the connection that people have had with them has been something new, you know, for a while. We haven't felt that way.
Again, watching that live stream, it kind of took me back to the pandemic. And by the way, let's not make this podcast about the fucking pandemic. Let's just put it in a little shell. We'll talk about it quickly. But just to go back, I was working in music media when Wake Up Sunshine came out in 2020. And I remember it was that weird window of time where, like, where bands were releasing music, but that was it. You kind of released the music and that was, you couldn't do anything. You know, there's no magazine covers. There's no gigantic tours. I think you guys did a live stream show then as well, right?
Yeah, we did a handful of live streams and things like that. Anything we could think of that felt like it was going to create some kind of connection with the fans. But yeah, obviously it was all remote. Dude, fucking album or magazine covers and things like that. I literally, that took me back to a very specific moment where I did my own photo shoot. Yeah. That was where
with a professional camera, at least
Roxanne or something.
I don't remember what public, like what magazine it was for, but I was literally sent like a camera and a, like a thing to set it up on. And then I was sent like this app and I had, it was like me and then a Zoom.
And it was and a remote. I did.
And the photographer was doing everything remotely this app. It was the wildest thing. Now I had completely forgotten about it, but yeah, we did a full photo shoot remotely. And we had to do it ourselves
separately.
We also tried to shoot a music video for Monsters remotely.
Yeah, yep.
And obviously that never came out because it was a disaster. But you know, we were doing anything and everything we could think of to try and make it make sense.
I remember I had Bill Burr on the podcast during the pandemic as well, and like just thinking of how innovative people were trying to be. Like he was doing stand-up shows in a drive-through, and the only way you could applaud or laugh is honk your horn.
Yeah.
There's no cheering. There's no one coming together. Like, again, making, like doing a photo shoot over Zoom. What the fuck is that? But at the time, what other options?
It's all we had. Yeah, it's all we had. I think it was inspiring, to be honest, to see all of the creative ways people came up with to sort of have some kind of connection in those downtimes, because obviously we all needed it.
As Jeff Goldblum says, life
finds a way. Yeah, exactly. Wise man, that Jeff. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so, you know, we tried our hand at, you know, it was really like throw a bunch of shit at the wall and see what sticks. And we did the same thing. And there were some things that worked and some things that didn't. And, you know, it's interesting because some of that stuff is even carried over and informed, you know, a lot of how we do certain things now. I mean, even down to this, like we never used to do press remotely. And here we are because it's easier for everyone.
Yeah. You know, and it's just like, easy to talk to people. Like I remember it was strictly phone calls. If it was international, you're on the phone. And then how did we not think of this?
Right. Yeah. And it's so some things that have stuck are great and welcome additions to how we go forth. But I mean, needless to say, I'm very grateful now that we have an actual barometer for this new music, getting in front of human beings and playing it for them and being able to feel it in real time. Because with the last album, it felt like we had sort of we had lost time, and we were sort of making up for it for, you know, a year after the record was out. We were finally trickling back out into the real world and playing some gigs for people. And it was so strange because we were coming off having one of our biggest, I guess, commercial hits in a long time. And so while we knew that the song was performing at radio and breaking records and doing all this wild stuff, it's one thing to be told that on a Zoom meeting, but it's a whole nother thing to go and like play it in person for people and go, oh no, people really love this.
Yeah. I saw an interview you did, Alex, where you said that like this Wake Up Sunshine kind of felt like a weird asterisk album because of the situation. You couldn't do much with it.
Right.
And this new album is a continuation of that. And I totally agree. Like listening to it, it does feel like it's picked up right where Wake Up Sunshine left off. Was that a conscious effort from you guys to be, okay, because of what happened in the last 2 years, you couldn't do a lot. Let's try and make a, for lack of a better term, like a Wake Up Sunshine 2.0. Let's just make this, but bigger and better.
It wasn't really like a conscious effort in that sense, but the truth of the matter is PMA and Once in a Lifetime were written 2 months after Wake Up Sunshine came out.
Right.
And then 2 or 3 months after that, Sound of Letting Go, Are You There, Kill Your Vibe were written. And, you know, so like, we're talking only a few months after that record came out, we were already working on some of the songs you're hearing. So I think it's just, we never left that mindset. We never left the Wake Up Sunshine mindset. We never went and toured and experienced life and came back and were different people. You know what I mean? So I think it really much, very, very much is kind of a,
I think traditionally our cycles have always kind of ended up being we put a record out and then we go tour it for about 2 years, more or less.
And not write at all.
And not really write. We kind of, you know, here and there, but for the most part, we don't switch back into that creative flow. And I've always referred to it like internally as like, even to our management be like, hey, you ready to start writing songs? And it's like, oh, I need to get home for a week and switch gears. I always said that. And so I think to your point, like we never really switched gears. So there was this continuation of like, even though the songwriting and the music was being informed by what the world was going through and what we were going through. And it took on some different themes and different directions, like creatively, we just never stopped. And so, I think there's a lot of informing going on from the previous record, but also just this sense that we didn't lose our stride. It wasn't like we were coming back 2.5 years later and switching that gear back on and going, who am I now?
Yeah.
Creatively.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Writing is a muscle. Like creative is a muscle. Yeah. And like if you don't use it for 2 years when you're on the road, you kind of have to, it takes a second to get back into it, like you said, but we didn't even get out of that mode.
And this album as well, it's more exploring new sounds, different sounds. You guys have been together for 20 years. Happy 20th birthday, by the way.
Thank you.
I feel, are you guys now at a point where the word divisive is a scary thought, or it's something you take on board? Because again, you hear the word divisive, especially diehard fans who have been with bands who not only have been so successful for 20 years, but have been together for 20 years in general. Divisive can say to them, oh, it's completely different now. They're not pop punk. This is like a pop band. Do you guys care about that at this stage in your career?
No. I think one of my favorite things coming into this record cycle has been seeing the vanilla ass record reviews from certain publications, like landing with, and I don't give a shit at the end of the day, like what people, critics say about the record, whether they love it, hate it, give it a 1 or a 10 or whatever. But my favorite is the straight up 5 out of 10 review. That's like, well, it's kind of more of a pop rock record than a pop punk record. And if you're a fan of Nothing Personal, I don't know if you're fully going to get this one. But at the same time, the songwriting is pretty good. And you're just kind of like, what? What kind of review is that? So you're saying the record's good, but it's not like the stuff that they wrote 14 years ago when they were kids. Like, so yeah, I mean, it's I think it's exciting for us to be in a place where 20 years later, there are still people who care. And there are still people coming to the shows and still people chomping at the bit for new music and embracing it, you know? And I think anytime that we make new music, we do challenge ourselves to challenge the audience. I think if you just stagnate and you just put out things that constantly feel safe, and don't get me wrong, there's room for that too. I think there will always be, you know, a want and a need for All Time Low to make rocky anthemic songs. That is at the core of what we do, but it isn't the only thing we do, you know. And I think to become a one-trick pony is to stagnate, and a lot of artists won't last doing that. And
we would not be a band for 20 years if we did
that. We would have lost interest, and I think people would have lost interest. And so you kind of do have to challenge people with a little bit of that pushback creatively, going like, nah, this is where we're at now, and this is what we're going to try, and hopefully you're on board with that. And I tend to find that a lot of the time when we do push those envelopes, like even if it takes people a minute, they do end up seeing what we're going for. And a lot of the time people do come around, which is awesome.
Two examples I want to give, one about our band, one about another band. When we released Waitlist, it was the first song we released for Nothing Personal. 50% of the comments were like, what is like All Time Low with a beat? There's a beat on this song, like a postal service.
Really?
Beat? Literally people saying postal service beat. And I was like, and we were like terrified. We were like, oh no, did we like fuck up? Like
the message boards hated.
Oh my God.
They were, and it was purely like the intro of Waitlist. It was people going like, oh, they're programming their beats now. This is gross. I like the back half with the breakdowns, but this I can't stand.
And that kind of theme of people being surprised by some of the stuff we're doing, and then that song becoming their favorite song has happened in every single record multiple times. And then the second example I want to give is Blink-182 self-titled.
I was literally about to go into that as well.
Yeah, when that record came out, I was like, I was probably like 12 maybe, and I was like, what the hell is this? Like,
not my Blink.
And now it's like, Jesus, what a freaking classic record, you know?
It's my favorite Blink album, you know, out of their entire catalog.
I think it's a great example of pushing the envelope while still being true to yourselves and just having the patience to be like, just wait, just listen to it. Let's talk again in a month.
Yeah.
You know,
but like to your point as well, like, can you imagine if Blink just made 9 Dude Ranches?
Dude, yeah. I don't think Blink would be a thing now if that was the case. And that's no disrespect. Exactly. I love Dude Ranch. But
well, no, of course.
Has but it has to its change. Place. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, and I think it's dangerous with music to become caught up in the nostalgia of what these things mean to people. Mm-hmm. Because, and that's what songwriting is. And that's what songs are. They, I think a lot of the time they act as anchor points for people. You hear a song, you love that song or you love an album and it connects you to the moment that you first fell in love with it. And in a lot of ways, that's what you become nostalgic for. It's not just the music, it's everything that it anchors you to from that moment. Mm-hmm. And I think to not challenge that and push forward and encourage people to create new moments with the new music is to kind of, you're never gonna make someone feel that way again just by writing that song 12 more times. You know what I mean? So it's, you do have to push.
Looking for a new sound in 2023? The new ATH TWX9 is Audio-Technica's flagship true wireless headphone. These fully customizable premium buds deliver incredible high fidelity audio with adaptive noise cancelling and dual microphones for professional call quality. So whether you're listening to your favorite tunes, podcasts, or just looking for some peace and quiet, step up your headphone game with the new ATH TWX9. Available now at JB Hi-Fi Australia and audiotechnica.com.
It's funny that nostalgia has played a part in the last 3 years. For a lot of people, especially during lockdown, like I'm wearing a Prince shirt right now. I like pop punk and punk rock are probably two of my favorite genres of all time, but I found myself listening to The Cure, Oasis. Yeah. And again, like
same, dude, literally same.
Yeah, Queen yeah. had so many influences on this album. Do you know why? I don't know why and the rest of the world got nostalgic. It's kind of just like, I'm going to listen to that album right now.
I got really into like The Cure and The Smiths and bands that I liked but never really got into, just like you did. And I know you did as well.
Yeah, I think for me personally, I ended up doing a really deep dive into The Beatles because I grew up with The Beatles playing all the time. And maybe that was the nostalgia I was longing for. It was kind of familial and going back to like, me reflecting on being a kid and what my parents were listening to and had playing in the house a lot. And I basically went in and went like, you know, this band really continues to be a mainstay in music. They sure did accomplish something, them Beatles. And like, I just wanted to do a bit of a deeper dive into like why their music has been so timeless and what it was about the Beatles in particular that really kind of stands out as being so iconic musically. Mm. And I think looking into it and when I thought about it, it was how kind of dynamic and all over the fucking place they were throughout their career. You know, it wasn't a long career to when all was said and done.
Like 6 years, like
9 years or something.
Yeah.
They put out a ton of music and it goes everywhere and in such a short span of time. And I think they were challenging people to move with them. And they did so much to establish all these different genres. And you know, obviously they were taking a ton of influence from things that they liked and listened to as well.
And music drugs. Was progressing also drugs.
And a lot of drugs. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Which never hurts the process. but you know, like I think from there, it was kind of, I was feeling really nostalgic for that music I grew up on. And from there, I kind of went and dove into a lot of those classics, you know, Elton John, Queen, Prince, mm-hmm. All these artists that I remember hearing as a kid and then fell back in love with as an adult and really just going like, what has made that music so timeless? What about it? What qualities come to the table that make it so classic for everybody? Because, you know, the first time I probably heard like 1999 by Prince was completely out of context at like, you know, playing on the radio. And I was probably like 11, you know what I mean? And didn't even know who Prince was at the time, but I knew, I remembered the song. And when I finally heard it again and again and again, you know, you can clearly,
as an adult, you can go back and be like, oh, wow.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think that was a big focal point for informing my writing, I think, for this record.
Also, to be honest, there wasn't a lot of music coming out in the pandemic.
Yeah. Good point. But I feel like I have to start a different podcast just based on this question, because I'm still yet to get an answer from anyone. The whole nostalgia effect on the pop punk scene in the last few years has been ridiculous in the best way possible. Like, look at this When We Were Young festival. Over 50,000 people were at the event last year for the first set of the day. When has that ever happened at any festival where the opening act
is playing to a full arena. And it's so fucking cool as well. Like, obviously bands like a Blink or an All Time Low, you guys have managed to stay successful and get bigger as the years gone by. But some of those smaller bands who maybe didn't break that through, maybe like a Hawthorn Heights or a Seosin, who are loved in that scene, they're now getting to play in front of 20, 30, 40,000 people. Do you know why that is? I've had Andrew McMahon on from Something Corporate. I've had Dan from Story of the Year, Vic from Pierce the Veil, and we all just stare at the camera and go, I don't know. It's great though.
I have my theories.
Yeah.
My theory is that at the time, it was already sort of a subgenre that went from being this like kind of in your back pocket niche, it's our little secret sort of genre. Mm-hmm. And if you were in, you were in, and if you weren't, you were one of the cool kids, yep. I guess. And so I think for people who felt like a little bit outcast, it was a really important genre. And then that genre crossed into the mainstream and had a real moment. And these bands sort of carried with them this ethos of like, we did this ourselves. We came from garages and basements.
Yeah, the Fall Out Boys, the Paramores, yeah, the Bi-Chemical Romance.
It was something that felt like it came from the underground, broke through. And for all of the people that were already on that wagon, it was this real like victory lap moment of going like, hell yeah, our voices are being heard and this torch is being carried by these bands. And I think what ended up happening is as it sort of progressed and sort of went back sort of into the underground, because it never went anywhere really. It wasn't as mainstream anymore, but it didn't go anywhere. But I think now we hit another point where people were looking back on it, reflecting on how incredible that moment was for, I think, people who felt as though they had this music genre that really spoke for them and on their behalf, as feeling maybe a little bit alienated or isolated. And I think it all culminated into this, like, either you were there and you were ready to celebrate it again as the world sort of went into this weird shutdown situation, or you missed out on it the first time and you were right. Like, I want to be part of something.
There's
like
a lot
that.
Of that. Yeah.
And I think there's a huge component of people going, whether it was because they just weren't into it the first time around or because they were too young at the time and just didn't get into that type of music. Cause there's this whole new generation that's latched onto it now and come on board. And I think it is that thing of like, we missed out on that, but we're so ready for that. We're so ready for that, what that represents and what that connection is. And I think it's been exciting in a lot of ways to see it blow up again, but also blow up in a way where it's become more inclusive and through the lens of where we are as a society now, which I think is really refreshing.
I think that one thing you touched on was a lot of people that didn't experience that scene and feel like they missed out on it. Like the amount of people that I've met, like really close friends of mine that I've gotten to know over the last couple of years, are like, God, I wish I got to go to Warped Tour.
Yeah.
I really wish I got to be part of that. Mm-hmm. And I just wasn't into that music back then, or my mom didn't let me go or whatever it was. But, and I think that people are trying to make up for that right now.
Yeah. Big time. I think there was a huge part of it that had to do with like the sort of idea of like these emo nights and things like that, like club nights where people could go and listen to this music with like-minded people and feel nostalgic about it. I think that kind of paved the way for like, why are we doing this in clubs with people listening to the music? Like, why aren't we just doing this?
Yeah.
Why aren't we actually going to concerts?
Yeah. It's funny that emo night started popping up in the US maybe like 7 or 8 years ago. But I mean, like, we first started touring Australia and the UK in 2007, and clubs were playing all that stuff.
We were always blown away.
They're back in a big way now. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, well, the first time we ever heard our music in a club was our first tour in England. We heard Coffee Shop. That was our only record out of time. We heard Coffee Shop soundtrack in a club called Satan's Hollow in Manchester. Yeah. And I was like, what the hell? I was like, this is a bar playing Coffee Shop soundtrack. Like, it blew our fucking minds.
We were getting invited to do after parties in the States. And it was like, you would have to prepare, a playlist of more like top 40 and hip hop and whatever, if you wanted to go and participate at those after parties. And then like, we went and did it overseas and I get there and I'm like ready to start playing like Katy Perry and stuff like that. And then they're like, no, it's like a rock night.
Yeah.
I was like, wait, what do you mean it's a rock night? They play rock music in clubs. And like that, I think that almost came full circle back to the States. And I think it sort of reinvigorated the entire thing.
I was at like a nightclub, like a genuine normal nightclub in New York, mainly R&B, mainly fun dance music. And then the music cut and then Cute Without the E started and the whole place went crazy. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And then straight back into Drake. I'm like, what the fuck just happened? And everyone lost it. Everyone was so into it.
That's so cool, man.
I think it's amazing. Yeah. I think it has a lot to do with where, how we consume music now as well.
Yeah.
I mean, not to get too heady about it all, but you know, like it's that whole, like the genre lines are all blurred at this point. And that idea of like, oh, you know, if you listen to rock, you can't listen to another genre if you, or whatever, like that's all gone. Mm-hmm. That bullshit is all dead. And I'm so happy for it because like those, that kind of social pressure that existed back then where it was like, oh, if you go into a store and you buy a Blink record, an Offspring record, and then you go and buy a Backstreet Boys record, you're a fucking poser. It's like, cause that's how it used to be when we were kids. And it was so stupid. Time. Like, just let me listen to what I want to listen to. And I think that has gone now. And it's so refreshing because you can just go out and enjoy whatever you want to enjoy.
I mean, God bless Post Malone, man. You know, like like artists like him who have just been able to kind of mold both genres together. Yeah. I mean, I love every song he's ever released. And I think people like artists like him are so important for music in general.
Yeah.
And I think he's been a massive, massive part of emo coming back.
For sure. Willow as well as another example Willow, that jumped out to me as a new artist kind of carrying that torch and that label as like a, you know, pop punk or rock or alternative. Yeah. But really marrying genres in a way that feels genuine and with very little disregard for what people are going to say.
Yeah.
And just paving your own way that way. It's inspiring and refreshing to see.
Machine Gun Kelly is probably another artist who's in that box. Very divisive, let's be honest. But I know a lot of people who hated it straight away realized, oh, wait a minute, Travis Barker's producing it. Now I just like him by association. Like Travis has played a big part in this, kind of like carrying some of these newer acts through the genre, right?
For sure. I mean, listen, we did Warped Tour with Machine Gun Kelly.
Mm.
Like he was playing on the same stage as us when we were doing Warped Tour. So he came up as a Warped Tour kid. And and I think him releasing that music is no different than any kid off Warped Tour doing that music.
Yeah. I mean, he was at the time was doing rap and hip hop on the Warped Tour, but like Jack said, was very much a Warped Tour kid. And like
he had an Atticus tattoo.
Exactly. Like,
wow.
I didn't know that. It didn't surprise me at all when the announcement came out that's like, oh, Machine Gun Kelly's making a pop punk record. I was like, yeah, totally tracks. Like,
I think maybe
loves this world of music.
It might have caught some people off guard, but we knew him. You know, we had been on the road with him. We had talked to him about music, and so it didn't surprise us at all. And I was really stoked that he was able to kind of lead the way.
Yeah.
Again, 20 years as of what month will it be? The official
March. It's funny you asked that.
I don't know. How do you pinpoint it? Can we pinpoint it?
This is how I would pinpoint it. And I haven't gotten a full answer yet, but I want to say it's March. But the first show we ever did was this girl, Jessie's sweet 16 birthday party.
Okay.
So we haven't talked to her since high school, but I need to like track her down on Facebook, see what her birthday is. And then we'll be able to find out what the first show we played is. But I don't have a Facebook so we just got to find her birthday, and then we will know the exact date of our first
show.
That
feels like it tracks. That feels like a good moment in time to be like, yeah, that was the first time we like went and put on our instruments and said, hey, we're all time low into a microphone.
Yeah. Do you remember what you played?
A bunch of covers. We did an Anti-Flag cover.
Okay.
We did Angry, Young, and Poor by Anti-Flag. We did
Girl's Not Gray by AFI.
Yeah.
Probably a couple Blink songs.
Yeah, probably every Blink song we knew to fill time.
When I Come Around by Green Day.
Yeah.
You know, the typical like first bit. And we played one original song.
We had written one song.
Called My Paradise.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was a song about going to a show with your best friends and coming home writing a song about it. And that show was Story of the Year, My Chemical Romance.
Wow. Is that like Taste of Chaos too?
No, it was, it might've been a part, like they might've been out on that circuit. Yeah. I don't remember, but the package came, it was like a local university called Towson University in our area where we grew up. And they did every year, they would do a Tiger Fest, it was called. And it was like, you know, 10 minutes down the street from where we all live. So we were like, we have to go to this.
Four of us went. Yeah.
This is a show for us.
Yeah.
And I remember like, we were like, you know, we were being those kids. We were trying to sneak around backstage and
we got
stuff
pictures
like
with
that.
Like Quinn from the Used. And
we were definitely like being little, you know, fanboys. And we came away from that show feeling so inspired and being like, that's a rock show. That's what we need to be doing. Mm. And I think it was like the first time we went, had band practice either that night or the next day. And like had this big, like, you know, a band argument about being like, we got to stop doing covers, guys. We got to write our own music if we want to be taken seriously. And wrote a song.
And that was the only original we played at that show.
Well, I mean, it seems fitting as well. 20 years, this last album as well is taking you guys in a new direction. It was, I know a lot of the songs were written almost 2 years ago. Have we thought about the coveted album number 10? This is like Quentin Tarantino's 10. Is this a big deal? Have you thought about it? Are you writing? Is there a giant secret we're keeping?
It's interesting, you know, like this record was informed by songs we wrote shortly after the pandemic, but a lot of energy went into finishing it off. And those songs were written pretty recently. And so it's actually like, to be completely honest, no, like we have not really thought about the next one yet, because we just finished writing this one really not that long ago. And the other part of this conversation is that there is like almost another half of these songs that haven't been released on this record that we probably want to release in some form. I think there's more to this record than is currently out, you know, whether it's a deluxe or a side B or whatever, there's more to the story. We're sort of still thinking about that because we're in that mode. But, you know, it's funny too, because like, depending on who you ask, this is either LP 8 or LP 9, and I'm undecided on where it falls. Like, do you say you going with 9?
I mean, I didn't actually think about it till you brought it up. Now I'm kind of like, but if you must think about it, that's not fair.
It's hotly debated. I'll tell you why. Because like, so some people count the EP Put Up or Shut Up as a full album, but it is an EP.
If it's officially an EP, it doesn't count.
Right. And then the other part is, though, there was a full length that we put out independently called The Party Scene when we were still in high school. It was not on a label. Well, not on a label. It was on a local, very small.
We printed 2000 copies and that's all it is.
It didn't have like distro or anything like that. So, and it kind of depends on whether you count that as like official ATL canon or whether the official ATL canon starts with Put Up or Shut Up, which kind of, that's always where it's been in my mind. So I don't know. It's either 8 or 9. We got to make a decision on this.
Yeah.
And if we are going to call the next one 10, if we're going with 9 and the next one's 10, then yes, we have to, it's going to be like, I don't know. We got to do some crazy shit. We got to bring in a shaman and record the whole thing backwards. And
just do like a really obnoxious 30 song, 2-part album. It covers both bases.
Perfect.
Yeah. Exactly. Guys, I know we have to wrap up, but I do want to ask before we go, as such a big fan of your band and obviously Blink-182, Alex, I was lucky enough to see Simple Creatures in 2019. We know that slowed down, A, because of the pandemic, and B, because of Mark's cancer diagnosis. Thank God he's much better now, but he's back with Blink and you're on the all-time low stream. Is Simple Creatures kind of on hold for now?
Simple Creatures, the beauty of it is that we started the project in order to do something that felt really agile. Him and I love making music together. It dawned on us, I mean, not like to sum it all up, that project started because Mark wanted to do a Mark and Friends record. Mm-hmm. And originally he was going to write a bunch of songs with a bunch of different people and basically be Mark featuring so-and-so on every song. We went in and did 2 songs together, and he called me the next day and was like, hey, I've been thinking about this. I really like our vibe in the studio. Do you just want to make an album and call this a band?
Which
was so insane for me, obviously, at the time. And like, I remember calling Jack and being like, hey, because I'd never considered a side project, quote unquote, before, anything like that.
Alex was so nervous to tell us.
I was genuinely like terrified, because I didn't want the boys to feel like I was like moving on from All Time Low or anything that. I was like, in no way is this like a disinterest in what we do. It's just like, it's fucking Mark Hoppus.
It's Mark Hoppus.
My hero, like, you know. So it was a really incredible moment. Long story short, we definitely designed and conceptualized the band to be nimble and be agile and be one of those projects that we can fire up at any given moment, and there's really no expectations of whether we put out a full length, an EP, a song, couple songs, whatever. And I will say, like, just the other day Mark texted me, and it was his birthday, and I wished him happy birthday, and he texted back and was like, you know, I miss us. I miss our band. I miss, you know, I miss
like an ex. I miss us.
I miss us.
And I was like, you know, both of us obviously are in, he's in Blink mode. I'm in All Time Low mode. And so, but it's nice that we every now and then check in and just go like, there's still something there. And
all right. Yeah. So there's one easy answer for this, Mark. Take us out on the Blink tour.
Well, man, why not? Yeah.
You make the record there. I'll do a band with Tom.
Just pitch it to Tom. Yeah, maybe he has the time.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, so yeah, I mean, it's really like there's definitely a chance. And I think, you know, when the time is right, when hopefully when we're both in a place where we have a little bit of time to think about writing for outside music, I think we'll probably circle back and do some
more. The world needs to hear Alex and Mark again on more music because it's the coolest fucking thing in the world.
We have fun with it.
Well, you guys will be on the When We Were Young bill together. So maybe we'll do something there. I don't know. Just spitball.
Sick.
Guys, thank you so much for coming on. Again, congratulations on this album. I fucking love it. I cannot wait to see you on the road back in America and When We Were Young in October. We'll talk soon, guys.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you so much for having us. Great chatting.
This episode is proudly sponsored by Audio-Technica Australia. Subscribe, rate, and review The Plug on your preferred podcast platform. And follow us on Instagram and YouTube, at The Plug with Neil Griffiths, and on TikTok, at theplug.podcast, to stay up to date with episode releases and giveaways.